Here are three things I think you should know about on this day. The UN Security Council has called a special session to discuss who really blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. Was it some Ukrainians on a sailboat? Or was it the CIA?
Be quiet for a moment. And I want to tell you something. The moment that this starts becoming chaotic, like animalistic, we're gone.
Animalistic? What the hell? In one of the most insulting diplomatic displays on record, a U.S. envoy calls a Lebanese audience animals, and that's just the beginning. If this guy's trying to help the U.S. cause, this ain't gonna work. It's backfiring. Also, the U.S. dollar is plummeting as countries in the global south like China and India take on the currency issue. And a historic meeting in Beijing and Shanghai that's coming up, and the Sanchez effect is going to be there. Our team is going to be there to bring it to you. We're going to let you know why it's so historic. Let's do this. All right. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're going to start our show today in New York City, a place I know pretty well when I worked there for both NBC and CNN. But today it's the place where Russia has called an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. What Russia wants is the following. It is asking for a fair investigation to find out who actually blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. And it's a big deal. It is one of the pipelines designed to provide fuel to Europe from Russia. But somebody decided to blow it up. Russia, much of the world, in fact, believes and is intimating at this point that it was not blown up by four Ukrainian guys on a sailboat, but rather by the CIA. Now, why are they saying this? Number one, the level of sophistication necessary based on the depth and the damage of the operation is not even close to being consistent with Ukrainians on a sailboat operating alone. Two, President Joe Biden admitted he would do this and revealed the operation to reporters. Oops. Three, sources inside the White House told one of the most respected journalists in the world, who then personally told me that, yes, it was a carefully planned and executed operation by the CIA. Now, despite all that, Denmark's ambassador is arguing against Russia. Now, let's listen to him. Let's hear him out to see if he can make a sound argument.
Russia repeatedly demands the Council's attention on the incidents relating to the Nord Stream pipelines, while at the same time systematically attacking and decimating Ukraine's critical infrastructure militarily.
Militarily. So did I hear that right? Did you hear that right? So he's saying that because Russia is at war in Ukraine, it then gives up the right to complain if somebody attacks its infrastructure, its buildings, pipelines, whatever, for any reason, anywhere in the world. Okay, if those are the new rules, let's go with those. Denmark, his country, went to war with Iraq. They went to war with Afghanistan. They were there for a decade. They attacked and bombed Belgrade in Yugoslavia. Does that then mean, Mr. Ambassador, that Danish facilities anywhere in the world are also fair game? What the hell kind of logic is that? Some would suggest it's the typical logic that is often used by many of the people in many of the countries in NATO. And here's, by the way, how some of the other countries at the United Nations today have been responding.
These attacks not only jeopardize energy security in Europe, but also cause serious environmental harm.
Guyana condemns all deliberate attacks against critical civilian and energy infrastructure. The targeting and destruction of such infrastructure impacts not only the countries in which they are situated, but can have vast, far-reaching economic and environmental consequences.
My delegation continues to be resolutely opposed to all attacks or any form of sabotage anywhere targeting critical infrastructure that may result in the disruption of vital energy supply chains for civilians.
Nearly 3 years since the Nord Stream explosions, an independent and conclusive determination has not been reached. We note that the investigations conducted by Denmark and Sweden established that the incident was an act of deliberate sabotage, though without identifying the perpetrators.
Back then, some of the council members supported an investigation, but so far, no one has been held accountable. After 3 years, we are still waiting for it. Denmark and Sweden announced that an investigation has been carried out, but they refused to present any results. Same as Germany that carried out its own probe. We expect Germany to expedite finding the suspects who committed this crime against civilian infrastructure. The truth should not be swept under the rug.
So the truth should not be swept under the rug, say most of the countries in the world at the UN today. Then it was time for the U.S. representative to speak. His argument: this happened a long time ago.
Let's not focus the time and attention of this council on an incident that took place nearly 3 years ago, but rather on ending the war in Ukraine. Colleagues, there is no benefit to repeating our many discussions on this issue. And the United States expresses full confidence in the independent judicial process in Germany.
Really? Full confidence in Germany? Really? So, if the Germans uncover that the CIA was involved in this, they're going to put that right out into their findings and let the whole world know about it. Let me just say that judging from past behavior and judging from the subordinate and dependent relationship with what many would call its overlord, the U.S., let me tell you something, that ain't going to happen. In fact, this young man who seems bored, may be one of the few people in the entire world that actually believes that. All right, let's switch gears now and talk about the conflict in Ukraine. U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff told President Trump yesterday that peace in Ukraine may not come until the end of the year. Speaking at a cabinet meeting, he said Russia has an offer on the table, but it doesn't look like Ukraine will accept that offer. Russia says it wants to keep the Russian-speaking territories that it has liberated. Ukraine is saying, no, ain't gonna do it. But wait, this gets worse, because there's now fear that this war may spread beyond Ukraine's borders to places like perhaps Hungary and Slovakia. Why? Once again, this has to do with pipelines. So let me show it to you. All right. You see that dark red line that's going from Russia through Ukraine onto Hungary, Slovakia, and eventually onto Croatia? That's called the Druzhba pipeline. And Ukraine has just attacked it, shut it down, causing a fuel shortage in Hungary that is causing Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, to say, whoa, no way. He's accusing Zelensky of escalating the war. Orban is, in fact, so angry, he's saying so in a letter to President Trump. In it, Orban accuses Ukraine of attacking the Druzhba pipeline just days before Trump's August 15th meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska. And he's calling the move a very unfortunate escalation. But it didn't stop there. Trump responded with a handwritten note. There it is. See it? It says, Victor, I do not like hearing this. Then, referring to Zelensky's actions on attacking the pipeline, he goes on to say, I'm very angry about this. That's Trump. And then he concludes with, tell Slovakia, you are my great friend, Donald Trump. Now this, in a scene that is being played in a loop for all the world to see, a U.S. envoy in Lebanon has attracted the wrath of practically the whole world for behavior that made him seem entitled and arrogant and overweening and domineering. Weird for a diplomat, eh? Unfortunately, his behavior is somewhat emblematic of what many countries refer to as the U.S.'s usual hegemonic bullying.
We're going to have a different set of rules, right? You want, please be quiet for a moment. And I want to tell you something. The moment that this starts becoming chaotic, like animalistic, we're gone. So you want to know what's happening? Act civilized, act kind, act tolerant. because this is the problem with what's happening in the region. So I beg you, do you think this is fun for us? Do you think this is economically beneficial for Morgan and I to be here putting up with this insanity? In cadence, with your kindness, your interest, and your thoughtful questions, we'll give you responses. If that's not how you'd like to operate, we're gone. Okay?
Can you believe that? Who talks like that? I wouldn't talk that way to my kids. Tom Barrack is an envoy. He's the U.S. ambassador to Turkey. Who knew? After a sit-down with the Lebanese president, he meets with these journalists and seemed intent on making them feel inferior to him. I mean, that's what people are calling his verbal assault. By the way, who is Tom Barrack? You're probably wondering, right? Okay, so I looked him up. He's a private equity multimillionaire. He's done several real estate, big, big deals in New York City with President Trump over the years. And, key point, he raised $100 million, actually more, for the president's inaugural campaign. Next week, in what will no doubt be a historic occasion, leaders from three of the most powerful countries in the world are going to be meeting in China, where the country will celebrate its 80th anniversary in defeating Japan in World War II. And in Shanghai at a summit, Presidents Modi and Xi and Putin will find themselves together at a key time in world economic affairs. And here's why. So as Donald Trump threatens all three nations with harsher and harsher sanctions and tariffs, he's actually bringing them closer together. And perhaps even more importantly, he may also be creating a union that could destroy the dollar as the world's preeminent currency. Now, look at this. It's a recent article in the New York Times. The U.S. dollar is having its worst year since 1973. The dollar's off to its worst start to a year in more than half a century. So the United States currency has weakened more than 10% over the past 6 months when compared with a basket of currencies from the country's major trading partners. And then there are articles like this one, which show what's really going on. It reads, trust in the United States is eroding. Question isn't if the U.S. dollar will lose supremacy, it's when. And if it loses supremacy, it will likely lose out to a consortium of countries, countries who say they are simply tired of being treated the way Tom Barrack just treated those Lebanese journalists, right? Like battered stepchildren of a hegemonic power. All right, by the way, I've just been told by my producers that there is an update on this Tom Barrack story on his visit to Lebanon. Apparently, well, I'll tell you what, let me gather all the information. Stay right there. We're going to be right back, and I'm going to tell you what's going on. But there's an update. Stay there. All right, there's a lot going on. Welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. I told you that there was some new information that I just was hearing was coming in on this Tom Barrack story, and we have it for you. Let me just look over. Yeah, protests have started in Lebanon. Apparently, people are angry. I think we've got some of those. Do we have that video, Gene? If we've got video of some of the protesters, this is just a small clip we've got of one of the first ones. But what's significant about this is, you know, this guy made a lot of people angry. And apparently he was supposed to continue this as an envoy. Demonstrations have started, though, in Qiyam with resistance fighters. Lebanon footage is coming in. More of it is expected. Apparently there's other protests around the country. And they're protesting him. They're protesting his presence. They're protesting what he said and what he did and the way he treated those people in that news conference. So as a result, we've also just learned that Tom Barrack has left the building. U.S. Envoy Tom Barrack has canceled all of his visits, left in his itinerary. He will not be going to South Lebanon. And this is all due to many of the protests that are forming around the country. Wow. Fascinating story. Timely, I guess. Well, we have the perfect person to talk to about this because He has been talking about this hegemony from an economic standpoint, and he's also somebody that I've missed and haven't had an opportunity to talk to for in a long time. So here is Richard Wolff, economist extraordinaire, author, good enough to join me now to talk about what's going on right now in the world. I have missed you, and I'm so glad that you're back. How are you, Professor?
Very, very good, Rick, and very glad to be back talking with you.
You're very kind to say that. What do you make of this guy, Tom Barrack? I mean, it does seem somewhat emblematic, doesn't it?
You know, it's the behavior, and I'm sad to say it, it's the behavior of the representative of a country that somehow knows that it is in decline, that its power around the world is shrinking. It can't quite admit it to itself. And so it has to act even more exaggeratedly. You know, if you were really confident of your position, you would never talk like that. You would never act like that. You'd go out of your way to be generous because that's how you show how confident you are. That kind of behavior, that defensive, aggressive, blaming behavior, it's a sign of a shrinking power, not a rising one.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was talking to my team this morning, and I was saying, you know, this weekend I was watching, I think it was on Meet the Press, that Mr. Lavrov, who is a diplomat here in Russia, as most people know, was being interviewed. And this poor woman did not know anything about Ukraine, didn't know anything about the economic conditions of Ukraine and Russia or the origins of what started the war. And she was asking some very just dumb questions. And I was feeling bad for the guy and thinking, my God, he's going to explode. If I was him, I would have been angry. And he just sat there and said, let me help you understand this. And I'm only mentioning that because, you know, Lavrov is obviously a career diplomat, and he's very smart, and he does this for a living. I was doing the comparison between these two guys, and it's pretty stark if you watch both tapes.
Yeah, and you can see that the confidence that comes out of a Lavrov, you know, is partly because they are winning the war in Ukraine, and the most of the world have figured that out already. And he comes from that position. He can afford it. But the desperate effort to come up with something, anything that can make it look other than what it is. That's what that journalist was trying to do. I watched that clip and it was sad. You're absolutely right. It was a battle of really obvious unequals on many levels.
You know, I'm going to share something I don't usually share with people, but, you know, I'm talking to an old friend. So the reason I say this is I looked this guy up and he's a private equity guy who's made tons of money buying companies and in many cases destroying companies. And by the way, this is not to say this particularly about him or all private equity people, but I just know that business, and I know many of the people who are on it. Why do I know that? I was fortunate enough to get together with a bunch of doctors and we started a healthcare company in South Florida a few years back. And it was just a healthcare company that helped immigrant people. And then some private equity companies came and they took us public and we went out as a $4 billion company on Wall Street. And it was a hell of a ride and a hell of an experience. But I got to know who these people are and what they're like and what they do. And, you know, Richard, let me just say this. They're not like you and me.
No, they're not. But it's the system that makes them be what they are. I wish they would understand it. I wish they would be able to break out of it, which, by the way, some of them eventually do. Mm-hmm. But you sit there and all human, all social conditions disappear, and you're trying to figure out how to squeeze more money out of whatever it is you're doing than the people before you were able to squeeze out. And what the social costs of doing that are, not their concern. Yeah. What the future brings if they do it, not their concern. They're in there, they've made their bundle, and they're on to the next task to do it all again. The net result is the decline of the American economy. They're making a lot of money, but the system that leads them to do it is destroyed by the fact that they did it. That contradiction is their lives.
I've been watching you a lot lately, and boy, you do such great work. And I would recommend for anyone to find you on the Googles, as you and I always used to say, so that they can see some of the stuff you do. And you've been talking a lot lately about whatever you want to call it, de-dollarization, the value of the loss of value of the U.S. currency. And you've explained in part that much of it is because of what China is doing. And I think you've gone on to say that China has, like, sold off something like $300 billion, if my number is correct, of U.S. treasuries. Explain that to us.
Yes, I'd be glad to. The United States, at least since the 1970s and in some ways even earlier, has been a country doing something extraordinary, buying from the rest of the world a great deal more than the rest of the world wants to buy from us. We've been running a deficit. And that has been a wonderful ride for the United States, because to make this as simple as I know how, the rest of the world produces goods and services, French wine, Japanese electronics, Nigerian gold, whatever it is, they ship it to this country and we give them green pieces of paper that cost absolutely nothing to produce, the dollar bill. All right, that's a wonderful benefit. We get the fruits of all that labor and we don't have to give any of our labor in return. But that's only the beginning. What do these countries do with all of the dollars they get when we buy their stuff, but they don't need it to buy our stuff because they don't have enough of our stuff that they want? They take those dollars and they lend it to the United States government. They buy U.S. treasuries, and that's how they make that money, those dollars that would otherwise sit there earning nothing, make something for them. Because the United States has to pay interest on those treasuries. And the Chinese, having been one of the most successful countries in producing what Americans want, what they buy at Walmart and Target and everywhere else, Americans have been the beneficiaries. Now we get a second benefit because our government doesn't tax American corporations. Why? Because it can borrow the money instead from the Chinese. Let me drive it home. The United States is the biggest debtor country in the world, and the Chinese are the number two lenders to the United States.
So buying buying U.S. treasuries is equal to giving a loan to the United States?
Exactly. That's what they're doing. They're lending those dollars back to Uncle Sam. And by the way, put this in your pipe and smoke it. The United States has to pay interest. The Chinese own roughly $700 billion of U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. At about 3 or 4%, we're talking about $30, $40 billion a year that the United States government gets in taxes from you and me and sends to Beijing, which they can use for anything they want.
Wow.
And they say, thank you. And we don't understand what we're doing. But here's the even bigger story. Because the United States' position in the world has been shrinking. And by the way, that's no one's fault but ours. Sure, our president will blame everybody else. That's what he does for everything. And that's what a lot of Americans like, blame somebody else. But the truth of it is, all of this starts with Americans buying the rest of the world. And the chickens have come home because the rest of the world, led by three of the most important countries, China, India, and Russia, have banded together, formed the BRICS, and together with the other countries that are joining them, they are now, and we have to admit this, a bigger, richer block of countries in the world than is the United States, even when you add the G7, which are Canada, Japan, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. What was once the center of the world economy, the West, isn't anymore. No one should be surprised when Russia's President Putin talks about turning eastward as part of a reorientation of Russian foreign policy. That makes perfect sense. He's adjusting to a changed world. And the difference couldn't be starker with the United States, which isn't adjusting, which talks like Mr. Barack talks and acts. The decision in Ukraine to fight a war misunderstood that India and China would buy the oil and gas that Russia couldn't sell to the West because the West didn't want to buy it, because the West had blown up the pipeline, and therefore, but they miscalculated, which is why they're losing.
How big?
That's why this is very serious.
How big a deal is that? You know, I've been thinking about this an awful lot, and of course, when I think about these kinds of things, I think about you, because these are some of the things that I've learned from you over the years having discussions with you. In that moment, when the U.S. turns to India and says, you will stop buying oil from Russia right now, or we are going to tariff you at the 50% level as opposed to the 25% level, and then India, and one of the Indian envoys came and did an interview with me sitting right here, interesting man, basically came back with a response, and this is what this gentleman told me as well. He said, I think what the United States is doing is unjust, irresponsible, and wrong, and we will not be told what to do in terms of who we can buy from and who we can't buy from. And in that moment, Professor, I thought to myself, the world just changed. Something just happened there that historians will write about where the world just changed. Do you think I'm right? Extrapolate that forward.
And let me tell you how you're right with a couple of simple statistics. What you just showed us, Ambassador Barack in Lebanon, that's the United States talking to a small Mideastern country. That's not India. India is now, according to the United Nations, by population, the largest country on earth, having outgrown China, which used to have that position. If you do what the United States, what Mr. Trump is doing with these threats against India, who has a long historical relationship with Russia going back to the days of the Soviet Union and ever since, you are playing with a very different adversary. If you shut off the United States to India by big tariffs, India will have to find other places to sell its exports. But like Russia found another place to buy its to sell its energy, India will sell its exports no longer to the United States, but to the rest of the BRICS. And what you're doing is you're hothouse fashion developing the BRICS to be an ever larger, more integrated, and successful economic alternative to the West. We are watching, as you put it, a historic moment, but it will be, for those with some humor, it will be the spectacle of the United States acting like it's the world's tough guy, as what it actually does is shoot itself in the foot.
Yeah, in fact, two things in that relationship that are worth mentioning. Historically, the Russians and the Chinese have not been great friends. And there's no question that the relationship between India and China has also not been such a warm and friendly embrace. But now, because of this, for the first time, if my memory serves me correctly from my readings, for the first time in more than a decade, Mr. Modi is going to the Shanghai summit, something he hasn't done in a long time, something India has not normally done. And they announced that decision. We're going to be standing side by side with Mr. Xi right after Mr. Trump told them that they were going to be punished for buying oil from Russia. This whole thing is connected, isn't it?
Absolutely. And look, nothing brings warring I don't mean in a military sense, but nothing brings adversaries together than having a common enemy. Mm. And what those three countries are doing is reacting to the economic warfare imposed on them by the decisions of the United States. I mean, declaring an economic war is what Mr. Trump did, a tariff against everybody. And now you can come and beg for me to make it a little higher, a little lower, make it start sooner, later. The whole world is confronted with the United States no longer being the hegemonic power that keeps peace everywhere because it's dominant. No, now it's a power using whatever it can to survive and throwing away its allies, throwing away much of its history in doing it. This is not going to work out well. And it's the behavior of a desperate society. It's the point I made about Mr. Barak again in Lebanon. That kind of talking to the press of another country is foolish. You don't do that if you're thinking. You do that if you're desperate. And that's what we have to understand, that both in foreign policy and domestically, we are watching desperation.
But let's talk. Okay, here's the money question. What do they do? Because the fact of the matter is, our country, the United States of America, still has the SWIFT system, still economically and in terms of assets, it's by far the biggest country in the world. So the United States is still the richest nation on earth. There's no question about that. However, these three countries in consortium can and might and are definitely talking about doing things to weaken that U.S. position. So here's the question. What can they actually do? How can they pull this off?
Well, I'll give you an example. I'll give you several examples. First of all, in economics, we use a measure of the output of a society in a year. It's called the GDP, the gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. If you add up the GDP of the United States and the other members of the G7, the Western Alliance of the United States, it adds up right now to about 28% of the total output of goods and services in the world happen in the G7. Mm-hmm. If you take China, India, Russia, and the BRICS, and you do the same, the total share of world output those countries produce is 35%. So people have to understand that that part of the world is now the rich core of the world economy. Mm. When it comes to population, it's even more unequal. The West has, the United States has 4.5% of the world's population. Russia, China, and India, let alone the rest of the BRICS, is almost half the world's population. It's an enormity against something very small. We're beginning to see a world, I hate to say it, but it's the truth, in which we have a mouse shaking its fist at an elephant. And after a certain point, that becomes funny, not scary. Mm. But you're right. The United States still has a lot of wealth, a lot of potential, a lot of economic dynamism, no doubt. But those are virtues, those are values that would give the United States enormous influence in sitting down in the world and talking to the Chinese, mm-hmm, and the Indians and the Russians, to work out a way that both of these behemoths can live together in the world. And let me give you an example, Rick, from American history.
Yeah.
When the United States cornered a little colony of Great Britain, decided to become independent, it waged a war of independence. We celebrated every 4th of July. They failed. A few years later, in 1815, the United States tried again to fight its way free and again defeated the British. After that, the British never tried again. They sat down with the United States and they worked out a deal that didn't require war between those two countries ever again. Why not learn the lesson while there's still time? Sit down, work it. Don't shake your saber. Don't threaten war. Don't push your boundaries. Stop it.
Yeah.
It's too dangerous. And the world is not with you on this. And yeah. I tell that to my American fellow members of this society. I was born and raised and lived all my life in the United States. I say it with pain that so many of my fellows can't wrap their heads around a changed situation. They should have known that the unique position of the Americas after World War II couldn't last like every other empire. It went up and then it went down. And we are in the down phase, and we better face it.
Yeah, you can't go around treating other countries like they're Lebanese journalists, I guess is what the takeaway is in this. Explain to us now what China is doing by selling off U.S. treasuries to the tune of $300 billion, as you have reported.
What the Chinese are doing is what any prudent investor would tell them to do, American, British, anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple. When someone borrows from you and you lend to them, mm-hmm. that's a nice deal. They get your money for a while. They pay you interest for doing it. And at the end of the period of time, you pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
And if they keep doing it year after year, and if they keep doing it more and more, you risk there coming a point when the lender says, wait a minute, you're borrowing too much.
Mm.
And I got to be worried that at the level you're borrowing, you may come to me next week, next month, next year, and say you can't pay the interest or you can't pay the bank. You know, every country has rules. You go to court if that happens, yeah. and you dissolve the business if it can't pay off its debts.
Yeah, risk.
The United States now has borrowed $35, $36 trillion, way more than its annual output of goods and services. We are at a level of indebtedness we've never seen before in peacetime, and only very rarely and for a short time in war. But this one keeps getting worse and worse. And what the Chinese have done, knowing full well that if the United States gets to a point where it can't pay its debts, you know who it's going to not pay them to first. The Chinese, because they're designated as the bad guy in this country. So they have been cutting back because it's too risky. But let me assure you, they're not the only one. There are three agencies in the United States that rank the creditworthiness of the United States. One is called Standard & Poor's. One is called Moody's, mm-hmm. and one is called Fitch. All three of them have reduced the credit worthiness from AAA, which is the best you can get, which the United States used to have, and which other countries have. We don't have it anymore. Mm. Those are all three American companies that have reached the same conclusion about American debt that the Chinese authorities have. The difference is the Chinese authorities are doing something about it. They're reducing their lending. So if the United States hits the ropes on this, they won't get hurt as badly as they would have if they hadn't reduced their debt.
So what's the final result for the United States if indeed this continues to happen? If China continues to dump U.S. treasuries, as you've just explained that they're doing and why they're doing it. And let's suppose, as you intimated, other countries join in and continue to do this as well. What happens down the road to the U.S. economy and its position, its vaulted position as the predominant currency in the world, for example?
One of two things is going to happen. The United States is going to face a situation it has not faced since the Second World War. That's 75 years ago, basically. It's going to face a situation where it cannot borrow every time it wants to spend more than it raises in taxes. It means our politicians, who have been able to go to the American people and say, I'll give you this, I'll give you this, I'll buy this, I'll do that, because they know they don't have to tax those people who would then rebel. They can borrow. If they can't borrow anymore, if the Chinese, the Japanese, and the others say no, they're going to either have to raise the interest rates to entice them to lend. And look what that'll do to this country. If interest rates go up, your monthly payment for your car goes up. Your mortgage on your house goes. We can't have that. That'll destroy our economy. Well, then what will the government do? It will have to stop borrowing. But if it stops borrowing, it hasn't got enough to cover. Who's then going to get cut? We're going to see cuts that make what the DOGE has been doing for the last 6 months look like nothing in comparison. We're going to finally see our politicians go to the old people and say, you thought you had Social Security. You don't. We're talking about the kinds of changes that have happened to other countries that go down this road. We are doing it because we need to pretend we have the situation that we did after World War II.
But
we don't.
What you just described is a Japan-like near collapse.
Yeah. And that's what, look, we are having a bubble in our stock market. We have a stock market that's held up high by about 8 high-tech stocks. The rest of the economy is in all kinds of trouble. We are expelling millions of people who work very hard for very little. I mean, you add up our problems, the rest of the world looks upon the United States as a rogue country. No other country is heaving tariffs on everybody. We're the only one. People ought to stop and say, well, what's going on here?
But
we are making every other country pay tribute to sell into our country. That may make us feel like a tough guy, but you're giving an incentive to every company around the world not to do business in or with the United States. An extraordinarily desperate act.
Let me challenge you a little bit by just, journalistically speaking, reading to you or sharing with you what Trump advisors would say to you if they heard your argument. They would say, yes, professor, but what we're doing with these tariffs is we're trying to create conditions where we no longer do what you have just said, which is simply buy things from Vietnam and from China and from all of these other countries, while America makes nothing, which means our workers have nothing to do but sit at home. That's not a healthy environment either. So the Trump administration and his advisors have been saying to people like me, no, Rick, what we're trying to do is create jobs in America by revitalizing manufacturing and revitalizing production. And the only way we could do this is to increase tariffs on other countries so they don't feel like they can do all the manufacturing for us. I hope I explained that well.
Yes, you did. The problem is the argument is wrong.
Why?
No, and I'll give you several ways of understanding it. No company that is currently manufacturing something in Brazil or China or India or anywhere else is going to make the decision to spend a fortune, because it's very expensive, to move production back to the United States. That's an expensive decision. That takes years to actually do it all. You have to reorganize all your supply linkages, all your credit arrangements. It's an enormous act.
Okay.
And why would you not do it? Because the tariffs are a sometime thing. Mr. Trump himself can't agree on the tariff. He has a tariff high one day, low the next day. It's in effect. It's delayed for 6 months. It's delayed for 30 days. Any businessman or woman in their right mind would never make a decision to move to the United States when you have this herky-jerky, you don't know what's going to go on, number one. Number two, the rest of the world is not sitting there. They're going to put tariffs on us. And you know what that means? Lots of American companies that either already try to export or had hoped to export, they're going to be shut out of those markets, like India, for example. And that's going to hurt. Why would you come to America if the rest of the world might be saying no to exports from the America just as you move to America? No. That makes no sense at all. And then Mr. Trump may not be here in 3 years. Yeah. He has a normal presidency. And then, and if the Democrats come in, or if people see through all of this, wow. No, they're not going to do it. You're not going to see it. And a piece of history. Every one of the last 10 presidents of the United States, Republican and Democrat alike, have promised to bring back manufacturing, just like they promised to revive the coal industry. Every one of them promised it. None of them have delivered it, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats. Mr. Trump, yeah, he does more than the others. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
But it ain't going to work because it too many contradictions that are that, and that's part of the fact that our empire is already behind, the peak is behind us. We are beginning to experience, sadly, that the ride down from being an empire is much less agreeable than the ride up was.
Which brings us back to the beginning. And maybe we close with this, because I think sometimes it has to do with personnel. I mean, you know about companies. I know about companies. I've been a business person. Business is about, you know, sure, it's about profit. But more importantly, it's about people and the people you attract and the people that you hire. And it seems to me, as I sit here and listen to you extrapolate these economic conditions and you do this and that causes this, which then causes this. So this causality is take someone like yourself who knows this stuff to explain. I get a sense these guys like Mr. Barrett, for example, I'm sure he's a good business person, but he's a real estate guy. He's a private equity guy. That's fine. And Witkoff is another guy like this. And all the people that are surrounding Mr. Trump don't seem to me like they're studied, they're students of economy or students of geopolitics or students of military tactics. It seems like he's got a lot of his buddies working around him. They could be the greatest guys in the world, and I'm sure they're very smart, and I'm sure they're successful. But does that make them the kind of people that should be doing this kind of stuff? I'm asking.
It certainly means they should never, ever be the only kind of people. If you want their perspective, have them in the room.
Yeah.
But you better take other people. The absence, and just my opinion, the absence of a historical awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, over the last 2 days, Mr. Trump used about $9 billion of taxpayer money to take a 10% position in the Intel Corporation by the U.S. government. Wow. Are you really unaware that what happened in Germany that we call fascism is the coming together of the top executives of the major German companies and Hitler's party? What are you going to do when the workers strike at Intel? Are you going to bring the army in to confront them because the government is the major taxpayer? Are you going to do to the workers what you're trying to do to the city of D.C. or the city of Chicago? You are going down roads that history would tell you. You better be awfully careful.
Yes.
Of what you're starting.
It's been done before, and it didn't work. Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it cost that country, you know, we don't even want to think about it, but that's dangerous now because we have to.
Makes me think of that interview that my friend Tucker Carlson did with Putin that everybody criticized because Putin went on for like 2 hours talking about history and why this is important. And he went back to Catherine the Great and World War I. And people said, what the hell is he talking about? And sure, he may have got a little overboard. But if you don't know your history, you will be doomed to repeat it, won't you?
The United States, let me say this as a final thought for you. The United States is isolating itself. This is not a good idea. Not so long ago, in the 20th century, there was a part of the Republican Party that believed in isolationism. Eventually, they gave that up because it was taking them down a road even they understood had to stop. We are isolating ourselves, and whatever stories we tell ourselves, a country with 4.5% of the people of this planet cannot tell the other 95% how to live, what to do, where to go. This is not sustainable. And we have to face it. And we're in a country that has a very big problem with facing its own realities. And we have a government now that is busily rewriting the little bit of history it wants, but rebuilding a statue to a Confederate general is not going to help us.
Professor Richard Wolff, nobody says it like you. Nobody explains things as well as you do. I'm a fan, and I hope that our viewers, the millions of them around the world who are watching, have benefited, and I'm sure they have, from your cogent ability to explain things that, for most of us, are too complicated to understand. Thank you, Professor. It's great to see you again. It really is.
Same here, and thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoy talking with you.
Likewise. And that's it for us. Thanks so much for being with us. As we always say, you can always check us out on the podcast, Journalistically Speaking, where I will take some of these cuts from the professor and play them for you and give you a little bit of an explainer as to why these things are so important and why we're talking about them. Also, I'm on X, by the way, and boy, lately I'm posting like crazy. I don't know, I'm getting back into my Twitter mood, or X, I guess is what they call it these days. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'll be looking for you again.